to live righteously.
It's time for another episode of the Cultural Hall, episode number 229, wherein we are going to be visiting with Carol Lynn Pearson. Thank you so much for being here.
Oh, great to be with you, Richard. Richie, thank you.
Oh, no big deal. I have to tell you this. So I'm at my dad's house on Sunday, and he's asking me, you know, what's going on, what's new, what's exciting. And I said, well, I'm doing an interview this week for the Cultural Hall. And he said, oh, yeah, who with? Because he knows we get, you know, all sorts of different guests in. And I said, well, I'm visiting with Carol Lynn Pearson, and not only him, but my stepmother and my, you know, at least half a dozen people in the room were like, how did you get that? And I said, you know what?
Ooh.
I am glad that it is that exciting for everybody, because I can't wait. And so I'm glad to know that at least in my family, it's received that well. But I'm sure everyone, as you know, loves you.
Oh, listen, I have to tell you, you know, I wake up in the middle of the night and say, oh, I'm in bed with Carol Lynn Pearson, and I can hardly get back to sleep. So I know what you mean, Richie.
If people don't know you, you are a poet, a playwright, collaborated with Lex Diaz-Avedo, which I hope we can talk a little bit about. And then author, and what we'll talk, especially in the later blocks here, author of a book called The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, with the subline, Haunting the Hearts and Heaven of Mormon Women and Men.
Yep.
So we'll make sure we leave plenty of time to get nice and deep into all that.
Indeed we must.
But Carolyn, I want to know about you. Fourth generation Mormon.
Yep.
Which makes you, does that make you pioneer stock?
Oh, absolutely. On both my lines, very. I come from a wagon company, the ship Brooklyn, the Mormon Battalion. So I've got them everywhere, and so, I love all those women and men who did all those amazing things. Oh, yeah.
Born and raised in Salt Lake?
Salt Lake until I was 8 years old. Then we moved out to Gusher, and you all know where Gusher is.
Let me Google that.
A tiny town in the Uinta Basin between Roosevelt and Vernal.
Okay.
My father taught farming for the government, farming to the Indians there and to the veterans, and my mother taught school. And 5 years later, they got us out of Gusher to Provo, where I finished growing up.
Was that a sad day, getting out of Gusher?
Well, actually, for me, it was a difficult... I mean, that's all I had known for 5 years, so I thought, oh. But, of course, moving to Provo was where my life really began, and I had a great experience attending BY High. You know, there used to be a BY High.
There really did? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. On lower campus, that is now where that wonderful library is.
Uh-huh.
It was essentially a training school for BYU Education Department.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Brigham Young University High School.
So, like, hands-on. So, if I was studying to be a high school teacher or whatever teacher at BYU, I could go and put them in practice at the high school.
Yeah, but we had very good teachers, and I had a good experience there. It hasn't been alive for a number of decades. But yes, that's where I graduated, and then I went to BYU, got a master's degree in drama, was in a lot of plays there, had great experiences at BYU. Yep.
And I want to talk a little bit about that, because also in that whole time you got married, but I also, and we'll get into everything that was, but talk a little bit about, because I feel like within the culture, we've talked about this here in the Cultural Hall before, within the culture that a lot of those things like pursuing the arts as any sort of career is a thing that is sort of irresponsible. Do you feel like that's sort of been a cultural... It's certainly, I don't feel like it's doctrinal, but it's like, well, those plays that you're in are nice,
sure.
But how are you going to afford, you know, how are you going to support your family?
Of course. That's true. And, of course, I could have always continued on in getting a teaching certificate, but somehow, let's see, and I had wild dreams that I could be a performer. I was an above-average college performer.
Mm-hmm.
I got Best Actress Award twice, once for Joan of Arc it was always a great blessing to me and still is, but I was not that good at all. let me just continue a little bit here in that after I got my master's, I taught for a year at Snow College, saved all my money, went traveling for a year. came back, and then this next chapter they want to talk begins about the marriage and all. Yeah. But is going into the arts, is that a ridiculous thing? Well, for bottom line economics, it is a risk.
Yeah.
It just is. But we are not here on this earth only just to play it safe.
Agreed.
I mean, we are here to be responsible, mm-hmm. and we have to find ways to support ourselves. And see, strangely, and I mean really weirdly, quirkily, bizarrely, the doors that opened for me were the writing doors. Mm-hmm. And we can talk about that in a minute. But, you know, I love the way, I think I read this once in Ann Landers, that the person who graduates in physics asks, how does it work? The person who graduates in philosophy asks, why does it work? The person that graduates in the arts asks, do you want fries with that? So, there is something like that. And mm-hmm. I have never had to work at a fast food place. Things just happened for me in an interesting way. That brought me into the career that remarkably I've been able to, as a single mother of four children, been able to make a living, never becoming really rich, but being able to meet our needs. So, you know, about what to go into, the heart and the head have to be in balance. Mm-hmm. And
I think that's the hardest thing, right? Because, you know, there does have to be that balance of head and heart, because I know a lot of people whose heart is in the exact right place, and for whatever reason, that little bit of logic or that little bit of non-risk needs to exist, because it's just not working out for them. But
that's
vice
true.
Versa.
But and also, see, the human family needs, well, of course, deeply needs the sciences and, mm-hmm. and all of those kinds of things. That's absolutely without question. But the human family also needs the humanities, mm-hmm. also needs the arts, also needs creativity. You know, and right now there are large boots tromping down on support for the arts. And that is to the detriment of the human family.
Absolutely.
So anybody who truly feels a calling in whatever way to go into a non-traditional field that in the arts and the humanities, or just take the risk to be an artist in whatever way, I would applaud that, and at the same time urge them to know that they're making a sacrifice, probably,
right,
and to be aware of how they can manage their life in order to maybe bring some stability and use some hours plainly for stability, and then some hours to fly.
Now, you mentioned that you have been tremendously successful in being able to go about this as a single mother, but that wasn't always the case, being single, that is. So let's dive into that.
Sure. When I came back from my 1 year abroad.
Where did you go, by the way?
Oh, golly. Well, I started out with Fred Adams and the Shakespeare Festival, not performing, but just as a group. And he had asked me to be in his second annual a production there.
Wow.
And so we had a group of, 15, and he was... so we went to the usual places of the British Isles and France and Germany, et cetera. And when they left in Amsterdam, I had already planned to stay on. Mm-hmm. So I took the railroad from Amsterdam down to Athens on my own. And during that trip, my luggage was stolen.
Oh, no.
And, too many really interesting details. I'll have to really...
Yeah, we'll need hours. I can already tell this in just talking to you.
So anyway, I spent time in Athens and in the Greek islands, had a wonderful time, and then met somebody who had been to Russia. And I thought, wow, you can go to Russia? You can really do that? And this was the middle of the Cold War. But I said, I'm going to do that. So I went to the Russian embassy. They were very gracious to me. They had their in-tourist organization with various tours that they sponsored. I chose that there was a theater tour, of all things. So there were about only seven or eight of us who went on this theater tour. I went in, was there for 10 days. I happened to be in Moscow on the day that Kennedy was assassinated.
Oh, wow.
And there was a tremendous outpouring of all of the Russians that I met were, as they learned that I was an American, they were very gracious to me.
Yeah.
And saying things like, I'm so sorry about your president. I really admired Mr. Kennedy.
Wow.
And, you know, that was a real life changer for me, just to see that, you know, as Matthew Arnold said, and as my husband Gerald often quoted, the same heart beats in every human breast. Mm-hmm. And that's the same today. Mm-hmm. As we look around this strange world, as we look at Russia, as we look at the Middle East, as we look even at North Korea, I don't get it myself.
Yeah.
But the same heart beats in every human breast.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I also went from there to, I spent 3 months in East Africa.
Wow.
Where my friend was, her husband was with the State Department. And then I met somebody who'd been on a kibbutz in Israel. And I thought, oh, you can do that? So I called and I just had to go up and land because nobody ever got back to me from their organizations. So I just landed and I said, where's the nearest kibbutz? I took myself there. And the man said, the kibbutz is a school,
okay,
essentially for Jewish kids to come in and have an experience there and work half a day on the farm, study Hebrew half a day.
Mm-hmm.
So this first place I landed, he said, would you be in Kita Aleph, Beit, or Gimel? And I said, I beg your pardon?
Yeah.
He said, you would be in Kita Aleph.
Yeah.
So anyway, I had a good experience there. And I got a good start in speaking Hebrew. When I left, I was able to have a half an hour conversation, very rudimentary conversation. And then coming back here.
And then you come back to Utah.
Yeah. Yeah.
What was it that drew you back here?
Well, I was out of money.
Yeah.
And I knew I wasn't going to live anywhere over there. I knew I was just seeing the world while the world was still there and I was still capable. So certainly I was going to come back to Utah. And I then got a job at teaching freshman English at the Y part-time. And then working at the motion picture studio part-time.
The LDS motion picture studio in Provo?
At BYU, okay. Yeah. And then the next year I worked full-time at the motion picture studio. And helped there with, you know, we made some good little movies there.
Like what?
Well, I'm the one that wrote Cypher in the Snow that has become kind of a cult.
Yeah, I didn't realize that you wrote that. You did?
Yeah, well, I adapted it. It was originally,
original
it was supposed to have been a true story written by a teacher that won a first prize in a contest a long time ago. And the studio had tried a number of times to do it, and they just somehow hadn't been able to make it work. So they just gave me the assignment, and I wrote a simple screenplay, really staying close to the story.
Yeah.
And
it's great. It really is.
Well, it is. And I know it's on some people's list of the 10 worst movies that ever come out of Mormondom, but other people love it. And it, you know, the sweet, true message is still there.
Mm-hmm.
It just is. So I wrote a number of
movies. What other stuff that maybe I didn't know? Because I feel like I did a bit of research, but I didn't see that one in all of it.
Oh, well, I wrote The Three Witnesses. I helped Scott Whitaker write the things. I didn't do the Johnny Lingo thing. Mirror, Mirror, I wrote. Oh, gosh, I'd have to go back and look at a list to remind me. But, yeah,
you're like too much. I've done too much. I don't know. You read it yourself. I lived it.
Yep.
So let's dive in. Marriage. You were married.
Yeah.
How long were you married for?
I was married for 12 years.
12 years.
And it happened thusly. On that year of coming back and working at the studio and all, I was in one more play at. In the drama department. And the play was The Skin of Our Teeth by Thornton Wilder.
Okay.
And I played Mrs. Antrobus. And in the cast was this very, very charming young man named Gerald Pearson that I was just so enamored of. And he and I developed a really delicious friendship. And after the play was over, we hung out together, and he thought I was so wise he would have a notebook and write down things that I said.
Really?
Yeah, this is how a romance begins, of course.
Uh-huh.
So anyway, I really developed a very huge crush on him. And he loved me. He really did love me. And he, anyway, to shorten all this, we became engaged. And then not too long after that, he disappeared on me. We broke up, and my heart was broken. And then to collapse all this, he came back, and we married. Just last September, I alone celebrated our golden wedding anniversary. 50 years. We were married in the Salt Lake Temple, September 9th, 1966.
Wow.
And it was during the time when we were broken up that he said, and he always called me Blossom. He said, I have to talk to you about something really important. He'd been fasting for a couple of days. Mm. So he told me then that he had had homosexual experiences and feelings, but that's not who he really was.
Mm-hmm.
He was deeply, deeply committed to the church. He'd served a mission to Australia, and he wanted to do everything right.
Mm-hmm.
And so he assured me that that's not who he was, and that he was confident that we could move forward and create a good marriage. And I felt comfortable with that.
Yeah, you're okay. You said.
This was in the 60s, and we were very ignorant about sexuality.
Uh-huh.
And as far as we had been taught, this is just a sin that you just get off track.
Yeah.
And then you repent.
I did this, and you
repent, and then you get back on track.
Yeah.
And you just find a good woman to love you. And I was certainly a good woman, and
yeah,
I certainly did love him. And so I did feel comfortable in our moving forward. And he did too, I mean, he was always kind of frightened of the thing, but
frightened of his homosexuality?
Well, just frightened if he could manage this.
Okay.
But he did love me as best as he possibly could.
Mm-hmm.
And so we married. And it was a good marriage, really, in a lot of ways. And we certainly don't want to go into details. But I've talked to gay men who could not possibly have a physical relationship with a woman. They would throw up at the very thought.
Yeah.
And incidentally, I as we were ending the marriage, I had a conversation with one of the three researchers who prepared the Kinsey report,
uh-huh,
Wardell Pomeroy,
and Kinsey scale,
and
right?
And he assured me that he said, your husband is a 4 on the scale, mm-hmm, you know, between 0 and 6, which means it's possible for him to have a relationship with a woman, but he will never ever have that as his primary need. Hmm. He will always have his primary need for physical and emotionally for a man. So just throwing that in there, we had 4 children, and soon, I mean, for the first year, he learned that what he had hoped for had not happened, that his inner workings had not changed.
Right.
And he still did love me. He loved our children. He never wanted to have the family dissolve. But when we both learned that things were not as I expected that they were, and that we really had this huge problem, and what were we going to do with it? And
mm-hmm,
so, during that time, he made a writer out of me. He read my little poems, mm-hmm, prior, and then again on our honeymoon. He was so excited about them. He said, "We've got to get these published."
Yeah,
and I said, "Well, yeah, I'm planning to do that posthumously." And he said, "No, we're going to do it now." So he made me put together a little manuscript of the poems, and he got our wonderful friend Trevor Southey to do those gorgeous illustrations. And we got in the car and came up and had a meeting with Bookcraft, Marv Wallen at Bookcraft, who said, "Oh, I could not possibly sell one book.
Poetry?
No, we are ridiculous." Well, I said, "Could you just leave them overnight and have your wife?" No. So anyway, we drove home, and Gerald said, "You know, anybody can be a publisher. You just need to know how to just do it and have the money. So he said, I'm going to become a publisher. So we borrowed $2,000 on my BYU credit union. And Gerald was very artistic and very ambitious, and so he created that little book. That's a lovely little book, and put Trevor's beautiful illustration, God in Embryo, on the cover. And by fluke or by fate, as Gerald took a package up to the BYU bookstore, the woman, the buyer, who by the way never read books, said, "Oh, I couldn't possibly sell any poetry." But she said, "Since you're local, I'll take four copies on consignment." And Gerald persuaded her to take a package on consignment. He'd be back for them. And so she put up a display. And, I mean, truly, this was one of the strange, strange events. The next day, or maybe 2 days later, she called and said, "You know that book you left? Do you have any more of those?" So it just began to sell by the hundreds, and the BYU bookstore could not keep it in. And then Deseret Book could. There was a period of time when Deseret Book ordered 500 copies a month.
Really?
It was just unheard of. So that's just the way it happened. And it was terrifying, but it was thrilling, and so that's how we started to be able to live and make enough money to live on.
I want to take a break for a second, and when we'll come back, I want to talk a little further about kind of then how it came that you guys ended up not being married, and then kind of all that leads up to the book, which we will which we will talk about. And you know, I can already tell as we're talking, I'm like, oh, and I want to ask about this, and I want to ask about these things. But I know that our time is short, so I want to make sure we give plenty of time to that. We'll come back in the second block here of the Cultural Hall.
Great.
Hi, friends. Dan the Laptop Man here from PC Laptops. I get a lot of emails with feedback from customers. Here's one. "Dear Dan, I just had the best experience ever. I bought a computer from Shane at your State Street store. I asked several what I thought were really stupid questions. Shane was super courteous and made me feel comfortable through the whole process. People need to understand how important it is to support a local company, especially when your experience is so good. PC Laptops really does love me. Signed, Satisfied." I love hearing feedback like that. It really just gives me the chills. It's the whole reason why I got into the computer business in the first place. You can get a brand new PC Laptops desktop for as low as $799, and it comes with a lifetime warranty. That means if anything goes wrong, we're going to take care of you. Just check us out at PCLaptops.com. That's PCLaptops.com. At PC Laptops, we really do love you.
Imagine running a small business today. It's challenging. Imaging and internet presence is an absolute must. Even with that, you're still a small star in a bright cyber universe. Now, imagine you have someone who understands how to get your site designed for your talents and then easily searched by potential clients. Imagine Lennon Design. Whether it's strictly a website or a whole package of logo creation, advertising media, and promotional materials, Lennon Design is your partner in business. They'll test the boundaries of their imagination to create something unique for you. When you need creative, affordable design, let it be Lennon Design. Call 801-699-3022 or visit LennonDesign.com.
It's time for the second block of the Cultural Hall, visiting with Carol Lynn Pearson. And I love that you say, well, it may be fate or it may be fluke, and I just feel like it's the fate, it's the destiny, it's the way that, you know, it needed to work out for you to be able to do all that you've done since then, right? You did your very best.
I certainly have to look at it that way. Yeah. And see, later on, as my husband and I had to have such serious conversations about the pain of the decisions that we were having to make. How to save the marriage, and then moving into the understanding that we were, in order to remain friends, we were going to have to end the marriage. But in the process of all those conversations, and see, we never had a conversation that I would write anything about our story. And it never occurred to us to have that conversation. But he would say things like, you know, we've been set up to do something important here. And I, he said, I'm sorry, it is so, so painful, especially for you. But I believe that you and I agreed to do a project together, mm-hmm. and this is it. And he said, you know, you've been set up to do something more important mm-hmm. than write these nice little poems. Which he was thinking of my work for women, because we never had a conversation I would do work for gay people.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, I believe that if we do come here with certain things set up in general for us to be able to accomplish what I hope we sort of were called to do and made personal plans to do, that we do get into the right circumstances. Right. So I do not look back on my marriage with resentment.
Oh, I wouldn't think that you could.
Oh, no.
Just for the kids and for the experience of what it was.
Sure. And it's been more painful, more difficult than I even knew at the time for my children, all the loss that happened there. But the doors that opened because of that for me to be able to do some really important work within the Mormon community mm-hmm. for LGBT people and certainly for women, those doors are, I would never give up those opportunities.
So if I understand, and I'll just kind of paraphrase it then, what essentially happened is he just said, I can't deny this part of me
yeah,
and who I am.
Absolutely.
And
right.
I need to go do this. And,
right.
and so that means we can't be married anymore.
So,
and then he contracted HIV.
Yeah. So Gerald went out to seek his fortune. And about 6 years after the divorce, he did contract AIDS,
mm-hmm.
and this was early in the 80s, and
right,
nobody
we had no idea
we didn't know what was
yeah.
going on, and so the final part of this story is that he did pass away in my home in Walnut Creek, mm-hmm. where I was taking care of him at the end. And
how is yeah. that? I've got to imagine that. That you have such a tremendous amount of love to be able to do that, because I can think of no other way that you could be able to do something
well,
like that.
Well, I did love him, and I loved him in all of the... I truly had a being in love crush on him from the get-go, and mm-hmm. then even through all of the difficult things, and I experienced all of the anger, all of the betrayal, mm-hmm. all of the that and this, but... ultimately, I did love him as a brother.
Yeah.
He was still the same. And Gerald never lost his light. The first phrase in the book I wrote about our lives, Goodbye, I Love You, the first phrase is Gerald Schoen. Hmm. And he never lost that.
Hmm.
And so, of course, I did love him. And, you know, after you go to Sunday school year after year after year, and you learn, inasmuch as you have done it unto the least of these, you have done it unto me,
uh-huh.
that has to, at least for me, that has to fasten somewhere.
You'd hope.
Well,
and yet it seems that there are some people who
well,
haven't grasped it.
Of course. I understand that. And we all do whatever it is that we feel we can do and must do. And we all do things differently. And all I know is that in order for me to be able to have peace of mind, this is what I had to do.
Yeah. Heart-wrenching.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And then I... As I mentioned, I'd never thought about writing. I mean, this is a shameful, shameful story. One of the reasons we moved from Provo to California, besides the fact that we had to sell the house from some business decisions that Gerald had made, we didn't know what was going to happen to the marriage, and I did not want to play this out. I had already become quite a public figure
mm-hmm.
in Utah, and I did not want for all of this to be played out there with people feeling sorry for me and judging Gerald so badly. I didn't want that. So anyway, for a variety of reasons, we moved to California. And
what was it that made you decide that? I mean, I guess you sort of have alluded to it, but I just want to know clear. What was it that made you decide to write about it, right? You'd never dreamed about
it. Well, yes. Okay. Some of Gerald's friends and I went into his apartment in the Castro district to clean things out, and I brought home the things that I felt I wanted to bring home. And I remember taking some breaks from that and walking around the block, realizing and all of the stories I'd been hearing, the national stories of young gay men dying of AIDS alone on the sidewalks of San Francisco, having been kicked out from their families in the South or in the East or wherever. Mm-hmm. And I knew that something about the story that Gerald and I had lived out could be useful,
yeah,
to a lot of people, especially to my community, my Mormon community, that was in about the same amount of darkness as everybody else,
right,
on this subject. Not just the disease, but the whole phenomenon of homosexuality.
Yeah, it's interesting to note that you're talking about 30 years, and there has been some light brought into the Mormon community now here in 2017, but there's still, it seems like, a lot of missing compassion and empathy and understanding.
There's no question about that we're not anywhere near what we need to be. However, of the average person being so much more aware, so much more enlightened, mm-hmm, it is really day and night as to what it was back yeah, in the 80s. But so at any rate, just a few weeks after the death and hearing again all those stories, I thought, you know, I could write something if I wanted. But that was a very frightening thought.
Vulnerable.
Yeah, and I talked to the children, and they trusted me, and they sensed that their father would like that, and then I talked to his parents, and they were initially, I can't believe you'd even think of doing that,
right,
and then came the first made for TV movie about somebody with AIDS, and they called me the next day and said, We've rethought our decision. We did not ever turn our son away.
Right.
If you could do something that would help other families, we give you our permission to do that. Right. And so I was put in touch with an agent who, and all this went very rapidly, and he was able very quickly to sell the idea, just the idea, to Random House.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked with the editor there.
Wow.
And I went through my diary. He said, I now have 60 years worth of diary keeping.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to remind myself of everything of this. So I wrote the manuscript and Random House put it out. And boy, I remember the day that the editor called and said, there's a place in Utah called Deseret Book that wants an advanced copy. And I just about melted. I thought, I am not ready for this. Am I going to get excommunicated? What is going to happen to
yeah,
me? And so 2 weeks later, she called back and said, Deseret Book has ordered 1,000 copies.
Yeah, they need
of
some more.
And they also want you to do some book signings on a weekend that they call something like General Conference.
Yeah.
So I did book signings at Deseret, and it was amazing. When I got to the book signings, there were lines already there, and it was a reverent feeling. It was like something that had never happened before.
Mm.
And I kept all the letters, and the largest file that I had was LDS General. Mm-hmm. Not LDS parent or LDS gay man or lesbian or whatever, but LDS general,
mm-hmm,
of people just saying, thank you for helping me understand something I never even could understand at all. Thank you for that. So the experience of all that was wonderful. You know, there were a few people. There were a couple of bookstores that from in there would never sell anything of mine.
Mm-hmm.
But by and large, it was hugely successful. And I know it was sort of the thing that first opened the door in so many Mormon families and wards, and I think for the general authorities as well, to understand on a human level level from a place of compassion what the whole phenomenon of homosexuality is about.
You know, as we're talking, I think it's particularly unique for me to be in your presence because I feel like, you know, call it impressed or whatever, but to point out you truly are a pioneer in helping members of the church in general and I think just people in general to really have that compassion and understanding. And I'm just, as I'm sitting over here, I just realize that I'm kind of eating up every word you have, but just feeling this tremendous amount of just sort of awe about you know, who you are and probably the lives that you've saved.
Well, thank you for that, Richie. And, you know, I do know that I have saved some lives. I know that because I have been told that. And I know that I've healed families. I know that. And that's just the most important thing that there could possibly be, to heal relationships. There are too many things that come between family members, between marriage partners, and that should be paramount. Anybody's doctrine should be secondary to relationships.
Talk about facing east. Let's jump a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. I love.
I just took 20 years of your life and went, we don't have enough time for that.
I still love the theater. Uh-huh. And I, as you indicated, I've written plays, and Lex and I did several musicals, My Turn on Earth.
Which is so great. And we've had Lex here in the Cultural Hall, and he is such a dynamic character.
Absolutely, yeah. And then one of the best things he and I ever did was The Order is Love, which is a wonderful musical about the saints living the United Order in southern Utah.
So, when is that coming to theaters? Are we going to adapt that?
Should. It should.
Yeah.
No kidding. It should.
I'll talk to some people.
you go figure it out.
Yeah, done.
You go do a crowdsourcing thing and make that happen. So anyway, to shorten all this, I decided to take a seminar in playwriting from a playwright in San Francisco, and there was a play I had already written, blah, 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 blah. But he said, you're writing a new play, quick, in 10 seconds, write down what is the new play you're writing and what is the theme. And I thought, whoa, no, I had to do it. So I picked up the pen and I wrote down, family confronts suicide of gay son, Mormon family. Huh. And so that's the one that I had to focus on during that time. And I developed it sufficiently in my mind. And of course, I knew, there could not be anything more dramatic than this kind of a conflict that involves the deepest part of your feelings about religion and God. Uh-huh. And then your love for the son that you created. And I knew that it would be a fairly a compact piece. I knew it would all take place at the cemetery. I knew that toward the end, the last third of the play, their son's much loved partner, whom they had never met, would arrive, thinking he would be alone at the grave, and for the first time, these three people meet. And so I was very excited about writing that because it is very high drama and it's terribly important. So anyway, I involved my good friend Bruce Bastian, and I took the script to Jerry Rapier of Plan B, and he really liked it, and they developed it for me a bit, and so they premiered it. It was hugely successful. Deseret News gave it the best drama of the year, tied with Hamlet at Shakespeare Festival.
Jeez.
But we sold out two times. It was brought back a second time, and it was thrilling to just sit there every night and watch these variety of people come in, older couples in their church clothing. A few people in wheelchairs, young kids with black and piercings, and, you know, clearly gay couples, and everybody, and it was just like it was as quiet as if it was a funeral.
Wow.
In there. And then sometimes I would see people leave, and it everybody was so deeply moved, and I would see a whole group of 20 people who had come as a family over there having planned that they were going to now sit down and finally talk about all this stuff. So, and then Bruce put up the money for us to take it on a limited off-Broadway run, and then into San Francisco. And it's been done now by maybe 20 different community or university groups. But that play, I know, has saved lives.
Right, and changed people's perspectives.
Oh, absolutely.
And that's
no
you,
question.
Doesn't that?
Oh, yeah, like, it's thrilling. It, there's nothing better.
It just seems so... So amazing what you've done, right? And I don't think that you've ever I don't take you as a person who ever is like, I'm going to do this amazing thing that's going to change the world. I think it's you're just this person that's so in tune, that is so like gifted and crafted you know, for God's hands, that you're just like, yeah, you bet, this thing. And now I've done it. And what's happening? And of course it's this amazing thing, but I don't...
Yeah, well, I do feel driven.
Yeah.
And in a very mundane way, you could say it's like the cement truck that says, see a need and fill it.
Yeah.
So, and what... So I have looked around for the needs. And, you know, I can't stand to see things in my community that hurt people.
Mm-hmm.
And we're still hurting our people. We ought to be, sometimes I think that many of us, especially people who have power to make things better, ought to be, I don't know how they sleep at night.
Yeah.
I think we should be up walking the floor with Lady Macbeth, staring at the blood on our hands, because we do have blood on our hands. We have so many LDS gay people who have taken their lives.
Yeah.
And it's unacceptable. It is totally unacceptable. And so I have done my part. And, you know, listen, there are plenty of people besides me who are doing wonderful things. We've
absolutely
got the Mama Dragons. We've got, you know, Affirmation. A list that would go on and on forever of people. But I do know that I sort of got in at the bottom, and I did something that invited a lot of other good things to happen.
I love it. We're going to take a break again for a second.
Okay.
And when we come back, we are going to talk about how you have again seen hurt, seen a need, and we'll talk all about this new book that you have. It's called The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy. And that'll be what we'll talk about for the remainder of this. And then I'm going to ask that we schedule another time when we can chat and talk, because I just want to hear more. And then another
okay.
time, because there's still more stuff.
But we can just go steady, Richie.
Yeah,
how's
done,
that?
Done.
Excellent.
We'll come back in the third block and talk about
great.
That.
Great.
The Cultural Hall wants you to help Utah Food Bank fight hunger statewide. Through your donations of food, time, or money, Utah Food Bank is able to distribute over 31 million meals annually to Utahns facing hunger. Even a $1 donation can be turned into $7.35 of goods and services. 1 in 5 children in Utah could go to bed hungry tonight, and 423,000 Utahns are unsure where their next meal will come from. By donating food at your local pantry or by visiting utahfoodbank.org, you can make a difference.
Time for the third block of the Cultural Hall, and it's all about the ghost of eternal polygamy. This is a thing that, as you mentioned right before we took a break, you know, it is a thing that causes hurt. And I had a conversation with someone literally just yesterday where I said, well, I mean, polygamy, yeah, I don't know. I don't let's worry about it later, and that does no good for people that are hurting.
No, it doesn't. And of course, you know, the standard thing is, well, God will work this all out in the eternities. Just don't worry about it.
Right.
Well, but why not make things right now the best way we can for people, and then whatever corrections God has to do to that, you know, then that will be fine. But in the meantime, it's not okay just to say, well, we know it's really, really painful. And
why do you think it's painful for people?
Well, oh, okay, here. First, I want to read, if I may, just
yes, please,
two short paragraphs from the introduction. And really, what I'd like is if we could just stay here for 15 hours and I would read the whole thing. Can't we do that, Richie?
Is it available
please
in an audiobook?
You find out. Oh, no, it's not. But I know I need to do that.
Yes.
I just haven't gotten around to do it. Okay, tell me again. I need to do it. Yes, I need to do it.
All right, Carol. Carolyn.
Yes.
Nope, I'm not calling you Carol. Carolyn.
Yes, yes.
You need to do that.
I will.
Okay.
I will. Okay, so here are two short paragraphs that maybe can bring us into where we need to be. There are many things that help speed our journey to a partnership Zion. Our Mormon wagon is full of intelligence, hard work, ingenuity, determination, faith, kindness, and service. But there is one particular thing on board that drags us down. It weighs nothing but is heavy as a broken heart. We carry a peculiar burden, an extra layer of male entitlement and female impediment that no other religious body in the Judeo-Christian tradition has to carry. A very distressing and complicated past and present and future with God-ordained polygamy. For close to 200 years, polygamy has been an extraordinarily troublesome subject in Mormondom. Some Mormons today, women and men, view plural marriage as a blessing that we will someday understand. For others, it is just a bother, embarrassing and annoying and not to be taken very seriously. But for still others, a great many, I think, it is a blight, rather like the crickets that destroy a crop. These are the people I feel called to serve, and I have never had a calling that I honor more deeply. So, knowing that I, as a young woman, and there's a whole section in here about me growing up and my seminary teacher bearing us his testimony that this is God's true form of marriage, and once we're less selfish and once we can use it again, that this is what God wants for us. This is the true form of marriage. I remember that like I remember that I was in Moscow when President Kennedy was killed.
Wow.
And that was the first time that the ground split between me and God, between me and my church. And anyway, in all of my growing up years, this, along with the larger thing of why is maleness more valuable than femaleness? Okay. And this thing about polygamy was sort of the final proof of that. Mm-hmm. Even though this is not good for men, don't anybody think that polygamy is a great thing for men and bad for women. It's bad for everybody.
Yes.
But anyway, all through my life, polygamy has been at the back of my brain saying, why in the world would any kind of a God come up with something as not only absurd, but as seemingly necessary as mm-hmm. that? And anyway, as I write here, not long, just a few years ago, I was visiting with a very dear cousin, 20 years older than me. But I said, we're moving toward the next world, and we'll get across the line one of these days. How do you feel about that? She said, I feel fine about that, but I wonder if my husband has taken a second wife already. Mm. And that moment made me so angry, I could have punched somebody. And I said, oh, no, of course not. She, well, that's what we're taught. And it is what we're taught.
Right.
Don't make any don't try to make this look better than it is, because we are taught. It has never been disavowed from Joseph, and then Brigham made it this gigantic thing. Mm-hmm. And it's never been, you know, the brethren I know today are just very confused about what are we going to do? You know, we don't know, blah, 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 but it's here. What are we going to do? Well, if you finish reading this book, I say what I believe must be done and will be done in order for the Mormon community to move into the kind of Zion that we deserve, and the ghost of eternal polygamy will be gone forever. So, anyway, shorten all this. About 3 years ago, I sent out a survey just under my name through social media, asking Mormons and former Mormons, women, men, to take this survey about their feelings about the idea of eternal polygamy mm-hmm. and the inequality of today's sealing practices. And on day one, we had over 2,400 people take that survey. And when we shut it down after 4 weeks, over 8,000 people had taken the survey. So I spent much of a summer reading through all those stories. And about 15% were, you know, polygamy is just fine. Just have enough faith. But the others, the huge
sweet
number.
Dismissing things that you're like, yeah, but.
Yeah, yeah.
But a lot
but
of
these others, and some of them were just one-liners. Some of them were stories that went on forever. And so I read these, and I began to categorize them. And I didn't know how this was all going to end, but I thought, by dang, this is turning into a book. Mm-hmm. So I just I saw these various themes develop that would be the various chapters, and that's what happened. And then I thought it's going to be their stories. Then I said, no, I want my voice to be in here. Mm-hmm. So actually, my voice is the one that carries the whole thing. And then I bring in over 100 small little snippets of stories from the women and the men, bishops, inactive people who have been driven out of the church with polygamy as like the primary thing that they could not live with. And a bishop saying, I've lost so many people in my ward over this. So anyway, that's how this book happened. And boy, one of the first stories that came in. And she put it in the survey, but she also sent me an email.
Let me ask you this real quick. So you said that you sent out a survey and then you're like, oh, but darn, it's going to be a book. Was there a survey originally just because you wanted to see the response, or was the survey driven by an idea that there might be a book within it?
The survey was driven with the knowledge that it was going to go somewhere.
Okay.
I had in mind initially just doing a huge website that people would start adding their stories, but then after I got into it, I said, no. This has to be a book. And
sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's fine.
A woman's story.
Totally. So I received a story. I won't take the time to read this, but she, a young woman, 3 children, back east, happy marriage. But the idea that if she dies young, she knows her husband will marry again and be sealed to another woman, mm-hmm. and that will mean she will live polygamy for her eternal life. Mm-hmm. That has become such a pain in her heart. But she said, it has turned me into a hypochondriac. Mm. Every time I have a pain, I run to the doctor because if we catch the cancer soon, then I won't die and my husband won't marry again and I won't have to live eternal polygamy. And she's a smart woman. This is not a dumb person who's writing this letter to me.
Right.
And she means every word she says because she believes. See, it's the people who don't necessarily, I mean, it's the more orthodox people who can find themselves the most hurt by this.
Right.
Because they really believe. People who are more over on the fringe can say, that's just too strange. God would never do that. But anyway, people from every spectrum if you're Mormon, you have to come to terms with this one way or another.
Yeah.
You just do. So anyway, I just have here so many stories. And then, of course, I have my own story of my personal story of growing up and finding the courage. When my marriage dissolved, everything dissolved. Mm-hmm. Everything I thought about God dissolved. Everything about the church dissolved. And so I tell you how I had to pick up the little pieces of God from the floor and hold them and say, is this worthy to build a new house of faith, or do I throw it away? And I was so thrilled to be able to pick up the piece that said polygamy and say, this does not speak of God. There is nothing godly about this piece, and how happily I threw it away. So I personally threw that all this away decades ago. But I knew that most people have not. And I have seen many people harmed. It just should never happen. That an organization as fine as the Mormon Church harms people with doctrine like the idea of eternal polygamy.
So talk about that for a minute with me. I know we just have a few more minutes. But you are a faithful member of the church.
I am a very active member of the church.
Yeah.
And everybody knows the certain things that I'm out of my closets on everything.
Yeah.
My bishop and my stake president love me, and they utilize me.
How could they not?
Well, of course. What's not to love?
Yeah, right. But it would seem, I think, to some people who would hear what you're saying, where it's like, well, this is a thing and this is clearly a doctrine.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a time? Certainly, I'm sure people have spoken about it, but... there has been any sort of question? You've been
officially
brought in
for
a disciplinary or anything like that?
No. And one of my stake presidents, during the time when the September 6th were being excommunicated, and I was spending my time 300 times doing a very radical play called Mother Wolf of the Morning about the need for God the Mother and then the history, 16 women throughout history doing that. Uh-huh. My stake president at that time and said, yes, I hear from the brethren about you, from seven times, in fact, saying, is there any problem with Sister Pearson? Should we do? And he said, leave her alone. Yeah. She does better PR for this church than you could ever buy. Leave her alone. I have been treated so well.
Yes.
I am loved in my ward. I have a comfortable.
I love you, too.
Thank you very much. And I love you, too, Richie. And I have a comfortable place being out as something of a heretic. I am a faithful heretic.
Mm-hmm. We need you.
I'm not going to walk away from this church. The Mormon community is about the best bunch of people I think you're going to find in anywhere. Mm-hmm. Anywhere. But once we get rid of this thing,
mm-hmm.
we can function. So, and we don't even have time to talk about how does it. Well, you know, just the fact that women in general have to worry about what's going to happen, you know, if I die and da 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 da. And let's talk for just a moment about the widows. They're sealed. A year later, their husband dies. They're in a little group that they sometimes call the Mormon lepers. No nice Mormon man really wants to date them. He wants somebody that he can claim for eternity. And if, well, yes, maybe we can have this sealing broken, but then that leaves this fine man who did nothing wrong floating around unsealed, unexalted. And I have a terribly moving story here of a woman who was spent most of her life with her second husband, and ultimately her children from the first husband. Anyway, they said, we give you permission to cancel that first thing. Anyway, she did, but she wrote in her little note to me, canceling that sealing was one of the most terrible things that had ever happened to me in terms of I lost the friendship with my first husband's family that had been so dear to me. Hmm. They, from that moment on, they stopped speaking to me.
Hmm.
They took me off all the lists. It was as if I had died.
Hmm.
And so, you know, these are the things that should not happen
no.
in a place that we call Zion.
Right.
This should not happen. Or if a man is brave enough to marry a woman who has been sealed and this, that prior sealing stays in place,
mm-hmm.
he knows that the children that he has with this woman, his own DNA children, are set to be in the family kingdom of that prior husband who has the patriarchal priority because he was sealed to her, and his own children will go into his, and he will be left without his wife that he's loved for 40 years now, right. and the children that I mean, we can look at that and say, come on, God would never do that, but that's the way it is on the books.
Yeah.
That's it. And I have stories here from men in tears talking about how they believe they will lose their own children.
You ever scream when you were reading through the notes?
Look, I did. I did, and I mentioned here. I sometimes I would read these stories, and I would reach for the phone to call 911, saying something has to happen. But I would call my sister in Southern California and say, "Can you listen to one more story?" One day I called her four times, said, "Can you listen to one more story?" I had to hear somebody say, because you know these things should never happen. And in our community, this excellent, fine Mormon community, this should never happen. Hmm. Now, what I really want to get to, if we hand this, I have a vision, and I, as a brave Mormon woman, as a heretic, call me a heretic, perhaps I am.
I'd never do that.
Only
if you wanted me to. I would call you whatever you wanted me to call you.
I lay out the things that I believe have to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I won't take time for that, but they sort of follow the way we got rid of the priesthood problem for black people. We did this, and then we did that, and then we found we had to finally disavow it. And mm-hmm. the general understanding now is that Brigham was motivated by the racism of his day.
Yeah.
That's sort of the way it's understood
now.
It's
not all the things that we were taught and explained.
No,
it's a lineage of this stuff.
I am asking for a similar road for polygamy to acknowledge that it was an error.
Mm.
And believe me, I understand what it means for me to say that that was an error and that dear brother Joseph, whom I still love, made an error. And I just want to read a little bit here.
Yes, please.
Of how when, okay, and I start this paragraph that I believe that brother Joseph that his soul will be so pleased as he was pleased to see the ban on the blacks lifted. He'll be pleased to see this problem solved about polygamy that has brought nothing but bad fruit. And it has failed the test of Joseph's own words of being virtuous, lovely, of a good report, and praiseworthy. It has proved itself to be a destroyer. Skipping a little bit here. When the ghost is finally banished, each young and tender girl will learn at church and at home that if she marries, she will become the singular and full partner of a husband of her choice, and that her divine nature and individual worth are such that she will never be one of here or in heaven. The writings and the folklore around polygamy, the old stories and the statements even of prophets, will have been put away in the drawer marked expired, and will generate no more fear than ghost stories told around the campfire. Every individual member of the church and every congregation will feel more open to the presence of our long-lost Heavenly Mother, for the disturbing ghost has been evicted from both earth and heaven. And the glorious goddess, full and sole partner that she is in the creation and sustaining of life, is welcomed back into the family. Marriages will be sweeter with no holding back a piece of the heart, just in case. I'll skip a little bit of that, but so many stories. I love my husband, but in our most intimate moments, I hold something back from him because I envision him doing this with other women. Mm. It's horrendous. A widow will mourn her loss, and then, if she wishes, look forward to a new relationship in which she can be seen as the desirable woman she's unobstructed by prior attachment. A man who chooses to marry a widow will do so with full confidence, et cetera, et cetera. And the claim of our church that we create and support strong families will be even more true as the ruptures and tensions produced by the ghost will have ceased. No one will experience apprehension over paperwork that plots out who will be with whom in heaven. All will breathe easily, confident that in the spectacular organization of the family of God, our Father and Mother in heaven, all of us will receive, with each person we have loved and been loved by, a perfectly designed relationship. And intertwined with every benefit will be the supreme one, shedding an old and debilitating distrust in a God that for many faithful LDS women and men has brought untenable spiritual and theological dissonance. A new buoyancy will render us a stronger people, a people more prepared to gift the Lord with our portion of Zion. And if we have just a few seconds left, let me just jump to the last chapter is very, very short.
I'll get to it, I promise. And I just haven't got there yet.
Okay. And here... I'm going to read this last paragraph of the book. I will continue to walk with the saints and play my little part in the story. And when my part is finished and I'm in that higher, brighter place, I will still watch with interest. I will visit that peering window I made up, that hole in heaven that lets us see the whole of earth. Maybe Gerald and I will take an excursion there after our promised picnic. He and I are still sealed, you know, but Mormon authority is the least of it. We are sealed as friends forever by the matter of love and grief and loss and learning, that eternal learning that moves us ever toward God. Sister Emma will join us on occasion, I'm sure. And perhaps we may even have the honor of Brother Joseph's company as well. He liked nothing better than to be with his friends. I will watch to see what may come of my own work. When the pioneers crossed the plains, often they planted seeds that would bring a harvest to those who came after. Divine economy that brings peace to one who plants words. I have told the stories. I have shared my vision. I am content.
The book is called The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, and Carolyn Pearson has been here with me. You know, we ask everyone who steps here into the Cultural Hall three questions. I'd like to ask you a fourth question, but we'll get through the three normal ones that we do. First of all, basic. Do you have a calling in your ward right now? And if so, what is it?
I am on the Compassionate Service Committee in the Relief Society.
Awesome.
And I'm sort of used by the bishop and by the Relief Society president as kind of a floating person to help people who need some kind of help that I might particularly specialize in.
Cool. Second, if you could pick a calling for yourself, either one that exists or make one up, what would you pick?
Exactly what I'm doing right now.
Yeah,
I just want to be a floating person to see a need and fill it.
The third question we ask everyone that steps here into the Cultural Hall is, what is your favorite part of your faith?
That even though I think it gets muddled with so many things, I'm kind of branching out here. The concept of eternal progression for everybody, mm-hmm. and to me this means everybody in the world. And these 3 degrees of glory, I think, are going to see more nebulous. Maybe they're going to be eternal progression for everybody, and certainly the concept that we, every one of us, have the kingdom of God within us. Mm-hmm. And Brother Joseph once said, I would that all of God's people would be prophets. Mm-hmm. And I say, far away from any idea that I have any authority to do anything except speak my own truth and my own heart. But I think we are, and I think we're encouraged to do that more than many people take the opportunity.
Absolutely.
I always urge everyone to speak with as strong a voice as they can, to speak from strength and to speak from kindness, and to do it constantly.
Then the last question that I want to ask you that I don't normally ask people, but I am curious. You talk about finding a need and filling it. You've written this book. People can get it. Amazon
is the best place to get it, yeah.
Just if you look
can get a signed copy. Go to my website if you want to get a signed copy.
Which is just CarolynPearson.com. People can check that out. So what's next? Because I know you said you're a person that's driven, and I know you, like me, are like, well, I've got an iron in the fire over here, and I've got a thing over here. Yeah. So what is next?
Well, this may sound weird, but I'm really spending a lot of time preparing for my death, which I hope does not happen for many, many years.
I
have a large life, and I'm trying to get everything under control.
Like what? What do you mean? Like all the projects? Or are you trying to write a life story?
No, all of my boxes. My boxes that will go to an archive. It takes too long to describe. But it, believe me, my life is large and unwieldy, and I want it to be very contained. And I don't want my children or anybody to be confused about what do I do about this, about this, about this. So anyway, honestly, that's the top of my list thing that I'm doing. There is another book that I'm kind of. I wrote this manuscript maybe 10 years ago. I'm a better writer now. I think in this book, The Ghost of Eternal Polygamy, I think I've done some of the best writing, actual writing, that I have ever done. Mm-hmm. And I'm a better writer now than I was when I wrote this book that I'm thinking of 10 years ago. It's a book called The Love Map, and it looks at the journey of learning about love, moving up the chakra system, which also is the way that the human family, the history of the human family, has moved up the very same system. And it's an optimistic look that we're now internationally and in individuals, and especially in love relationships, stuck in the third chakra of power, of my will over yours, sort of the law of Moses place.
Yeah.
And our journey, our challenge right now is to move from the fourth chakra up to the third, that is love, that Jesus and all the luminaries that have ever graced this planet have urged us to move, where we have to move in our personal relationships. And similarly, the world right now is stuck in the third. Mm. Countries are stuck in my will over your will. And it's an optimistic look because this is a historical, evolutionary kind of thing.
Yeah.
And we can have confidence that if enough of us will, and there will be a tipping point.
Yeah.
Where if enough of us as individuals move out of the third, my will over yours, into the fourth, loving, one win-win all the time, that can spill over, and internationally we can come to that place, and that will be the millennium.
I love it.
So I'm playing with that, and I love playing with that.
I love hearing your passion about it. Our time is up. So time to put this thing to bed. We hope that this episode has nourished and strengthened your body, that if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week...
And do you the good that you need.
Yeah. And do you the good you need. That if you weren't healthy enough to listen this week, that you'll be healthy enough to listen next week, and that when the time comes, you'll be able to travel home in safety. In the meantime, we'll be saving a seat for you on the back row of the Cultural Hall.
Thank you, Richie.
Save me a seat. It's sure to be neat.